Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 12, 2004. Today's session number is BRM 2004-01. Today's speaker is Mark Brocker. The lesson for today is Ethics Empowered by the Gospel: Why Adam and Eve Ate the Apple. Let's listen in.
Ready to roll. My name's Mark Brocker, and you may have seen the information, but I'm lead pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Tacoma, Washington. It's actually in Parkland with a Tacoma address, and we're the church, well, I've started saying now Pacific Lutheran University is across the street from us. So. The focus for the week, now you won't necessarily be at every session, but I'm using the title Ethics Empowered by the Gospel and really trying to ask the question, what difference does the gospel make when it comes to doing ethics? And part of what's behind this is a sense that at times we will go to church, but when it comes to doing ethics and making decisions, we often end up just doing it like everybody else is doing it. And so I want to really look, what is there distinctive about the gospel that helps us in the ethical process, and at the same time, make use of all the resources that are available to us from a variety of sources. So that gives you some idea of the overall thrust of what I'll be doing this week. The title today is Why Adam and Eve Ate the Apple, and this will serve as a basic introduction to the approach, and really trying to lift up a distinctive approach to ethics. And it is one approach. Now, I'm an evangelical Lutheran pastor, and what I say is this is not even the evangelical Lutheran approach. This is a evangelical Lutheran approach, and there are certainly other approaches to ethics, but I want to lift this one up, and hopefully it'll be stimulating to all of us and help us think through how it is that we approach ethics and how God calls each of us and the communities that we're part of, how God calls us to approach ethics. I like to, commercial here, there are a few copies of Bonhoeffer's Ethics in the bookstore, and this is sort of a plug for it, and then I'm going to tell you that you may want to buy the new edition of Bonhoeffer's Ethics that will be coming out from Augsburg Fortress at the end of the year. But this one is available now, but the new one is completely redone, and so I would encourage people, even if you got this copy, if you're really interested in Bonhoeffer and ethics, and this isn't all Bonhoeffer ethics, but that's certainly a key influence, this would be a good book, and I'll be referring to this at different times throughout my presentations.
But he's dead.
He is. What's that?
How can the book change?
Completely new translation. There's a 16-volume set of Bonhoeffer's works that's being done. Germans did 16 volumes, and now we have an English team that is redoing all the volumes. I'm actually working on volume 16, which is called Conspiracy and Imprisonment. It has letters, essays, not many sermons, because he was banned from speaking in public during the war years. So there's just one sermon in our section, but all that's being redone. And the ethics volume will be, the whole structure of it is completely being redone because he never finished it.
Oh.
And so people have been trying to put it together the best they can. And the new edition will be very helpful. They'll have many more editorial helps, good introductions, and so on. And so I really recommend that new edition. But this one is available, and it's certainly worth, if you get excited about something, you need to seize the day and read it now and not wait. I like to do something I call priming the pump to get started, and just in groups of three or four, and I never give you enough time for this, it's to prime the pump. If you remember the old pump back in Wisconsin, we had a pump and you had to put some water in to get things rolling. Well, that's the purpose of these. I'm going to give you two questions, and the first one I want you to discuss just for two or three minutes in groups of maybe three or four max is, what public figure exemplifies living with ethical integrity, and then give a brief reason why. So what public figure exemplifies living with ethical integrity, and give a reason why? Can be living, but if it's somebody that you want to lift up that maybe is no longer living, that's always possible too. So let's just do that right where you are, in groups of three or four, talk about that first question. What public figure exemplifies living with ethical integrity?
I'll repeat that.
All right.
All right, I'm going to interrupt you no matter where you are. just call your attention back. Just, I'm always interested, what were some of the names that were thrown out? And if you hear a name, then raise your hand if you also...
Couldn't think of anybody.
Couldn't think of anybody, okay. So,
public official.
Okay, Jimmy Carter came up. How many times Jimmy Carter's name came up? Any others that came up?
Nelson Mandela, he's not
no? Okay.
U.S. But.
No, it didn't have to be U.S. It's definitely a public figure. Nelson Mandela?
Gandhi.
Billy Graham, partly for sexual ethics.
Well, that's for sure. Billy Graham, I think, is viewed that. Any other names? Mother Teresa?
Oh, she said Marion White Edmonds.
She's dead. Okay.
All right. Yeah, you could have. It could be dead.
I said it could be dead.
Now, I have been in groups where when they're struggling to find figures, I do allow them also to pick somebody out that does not exemplify ethical integrity. The problem is the rabid Republicans tend to lift up Bill Clinton, and the rabid Democrats tend to lift up George Bush. So that's that.
Martin Luther King Jr., okay. His public life was full of integrity.
Yeah.
His private life was more complicated.
Well,
but,
and that may point out something about when we look at ethics, often one of the things we have to deal with is how God can work through people to accomplish good things who may have other aspects of their life that do not exemplify what we would think is responsibility or ethical integrity in any way. So that can be the nature of ethics.
You mentioned Bob Falder, the author.
No.
Oh, okay.
And we were just beginning to debate, was there a difference between personal integrity and ethics? And that's just for the reverend point.
That won't go away, so keep
that
question.
Did she say Barbara Kingsolver? Is that what she said?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me, I'm going to move on here, but the other question that I just want you to think about here as we enter into this, there's an expression that says the end justifies the means, and it's a loaded question because you'll see as I go through ethics that I tend to really come on hard against what I call one principle type ethics, where you decide things on the basis of ends or it's the means or some other principle. And I really call that into question as we go through this. So, but that was another question that I think just to have in your mind, does the end justify the means? And if you say no, then why not? And if you say yes, then you have to present the case. Why is it that the end justifies the means? Let me share a case study with you just briefly, and this is something I've used with confirmation classes often when I'm teaching them the Ten Commandments. And the story goes something like this. And there was a young boy who's 7 years old, and he has a young sister who's three, a single mother, and things are tight, and they do get food stamps, but this one particular month, the food stamps run out, and there's not enough food around the house, and this boy kind of takes care of his little sister and looks out for her, and he, with not enough food in the house, he gets concerned about this, and finally he just can't take it anymore, and he goes to a local grocery store, manages to steal some food, and take it home to his sister so that she won't be hungry. And the question I lift up then is I would say, well, on the basis of the Ten Commandments, did he do the right thing or the wrong thing? Well, and he might say, wrong, and you'd say why?
Because he's stealing.
Okay, he's stealing. He's breaking the seventh commandment.
There are other ways of obtaining food.
There would be, but he's a seven-year-old. Okay, so is there anybody? What
so,
might be a reason
so he
to
could
say?
Beg.
What's that?
He could beg.
Okay, there's other things he could do, but given in his circumstances and who he is, he's concerned about his sister being hungry, and so I would argue using Luther's line about the fifth commandment, which he said, you shall not kill, but he said there's a positive way of phrasing that fifth commandment, which is you shall do everything you can to look out for the physical well-being of your neighbor. And I would argue the boy is motivated by his concern for his hungry sister. Now then you could go in and we'd start analyzing this and say, well, aren't there some other things he could have done? But again, we have to take into account what he's actually capable of knowing and figuring out at 7 years old. So, we're not going to resolve this, but I'm just lifting this up as an example where commandments that we would want to teach, and certainly I teach the commandments to my children, And I don't want them coming to me and saying, well, Dad, I did take this, but let me give you some reasons why it's justified. No, you still got to teach the commandments, but it points out that there are situations in which good values, solid values that we want to teach, don't always just work easily together. Now, I told that story in confirmation, and I also started telling this in new members classes that I teach. And so I'm telling, and I've actually, this story is somewhat made up. I mean, there are probably examples like this, but I had made up this story to make a point. And this teacher goes, oh, that happens all the time. And I said, oh, what do you mean? And she said, well, tell us what you mean. Well, she says, I work in those local schools. And he said, we've got over 50% of the kids in our school are on some kind of either reduced or free lunches and breakfasts. And she said, we have siblings taking home food all the time for their siblings at home. And basically she was saying, and we've just chosen to look the other way. And the question would be, you know, is that right or wrong? And then you start looking at that, and the teachers are looking the other way, but if it make an issue, in their minds, there are going to be kids going hungry if we put a stop to this. You can also argue there's taxpayer money is being handled in this. Is this right or wrong? So all of a sudden, this story I had just, in a sense, made up, was brought home that here's a teacher that's dealing with this on an everyday basis, and not an easy one. Who would be the one to throw the first stone at either the teacher or the sibling that's taking home the food, or the teacher that's choosing at this point to look the other way? Now, to do a full analysis, we might want to talk about what teachers might do to advocate for, you know, you'd have to work politically then. If you're concerned about how that's getting resolved, then you'd have to get involved politically in order to bring changes, so that kind of thing is not necessary.
What you're talking about is motivational ethics.
That's part of it.
I mean, it basically is, in that story, you're talking about motivational ethics.
You'd have to take the motives, become one key thing to look at in that case.
Sir?
Yeah.
Isn't condoning that what we call situational ethics?
That's one, and what I would lift up is that I'm going to make a case that the situation does need to be taken into account.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, I'm also, though, don't want to just say support situational ethics that comes out kind of whatever my opinion is the right one. You know, that situational ethics can quickly become, you know, however I sort out things is the way things will be, whether we say it that way or not. So I'm not arguing here for a situational ethics in kind of the simple sense that I think at times has been advocated. Well, let me move on to Genesis 3, 1 through 7. This is a story of Adam and Eve in the garden. And this is a wonderful account here. Now the serpent was more crafty than any other wild animal that the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, did God say, you shall not eat from any tree in the garden? The woman said to the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden. But God said, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the middle of the garden, nor shall you touch it, or you shall die. The serpent said to the woman, you will not die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. And their eyes were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made loincloths for themselves. There's many points that could be lifted up from this passage, but I want to focus in particular on this line that when in eating, you will be like God, knowing good and evil. Be like God, knowing good and evil. And this, I want to lift this up as what I see as a fundamental temptation for us as human beings, is this desire to be like God, knowing good and evil. And I would even press this here. I would call this certain knowledge of good and certain knowledge of evil. I think that's what we're talking about here. In some sense, we're going to work with categories of good and evil, and they're useful to us. But there was this desire to be like God and have the kind of knowledge that only God could give. And that was attractive and tempting and desirable. Because there's something about in us that seems to desire a certain kind of certainty, and certainly about our own actions. Now, in the Lutheran tradition that I grew up with, you know, we had justification by grace through faith drilled into us. This was that only God can justify us, and we can't justify ourselves. And I would suggest that in ethics, then, kind of going directly against that teaching would be to do anything which is attempt to justify ourselves. And I think this desire for certain knowledge of good and evil, to have that kind of knowledge, is often an attempt to have that to justify ourselves. And so often, much of the reasoning we do in making ethical decision making is along the lines of this attempting to justify ourselves. And it can happen either before we do something, we want to know before we do something, we want to know for certain, or we want to know after the fact and justify something we've already done. Let me give you a couple of examples of this, and it's always easier to look at those who, not us, see, you look at others and see how the mistakes they make. But when I was pastor down in Oregon, and this would have been back, 93, 94, that time period, great battle really going on in the state over the issue of special rights, privileges for gays and lesbians. And there was a group called the Oregon Citizens Alliance that was leading the drive to get a resolution passed in the state which would prevent, in their minds, this special privileges or rights for gays and lesbians. The leader of that group was named Lon Maben. And Lon Maben was going around and was in the press, very much a public figure at that point. In the McMinnville Ministerial Association, the president decided to invite him to come and speak to our association. And we kept this under wraps because we did not want demonstrations and we didn't want the press there and so on. Now, I was the vice president and I was relatively new in McMinnville. And the new people get elected to be officers of this ministerial association. I knew this, so I was very wise, and I did not want to be treasurer or secretary because they actually had to do something. And I didn't want to be president because the president had to run meetings, so I offered to be vice president. Well, this president lines up Lon Maben, and I had just come from Illinois before this. He lines up Lon Maben to speak and then takes a call to Illinois. That left me to be the moderator for this session, and we had conservatives and liberals would come to this, and normally it was, you know, we'd eat lunch together, we could do that, that was something we could work out, but here's Lon Maben coming in a very hot topic, and so Lon comes and he makes a presentation to us, and he's a very basic presentation on, biblically based, on why Christians should be involved in politics. And actually, everybody's head was nodding for the most part during this. That nobody was disagreeing with it. Yeah, Christians should be involved in politics in some way. Then he went and started talking about the issue itself, and he made the statement, our goal is to reestablish moral absolutes in society. That's our goal. And we had to start somewhere, and so we started with this issue. So reestablish moral absolutes. And now again, I'm moderating this, so I'm just making sure the discussion's going back and forth and recognizing people in that. But then right towards the end, I did make one point to him, and I referred to this, and I said, it seems to me, because I had to appeal biblically to Lon Maben, or he was not going to listen to me at all. But it says, it seems to me that one of the mistakes that Adam and Eve got into is they wanted something like absolute knowledge of moral right and wrong. And I said, I would lift that up as a caution in what you're doing, this desire for moral absolute. I think you're presuming a level of knowledge that you don't have. I'm not saying you can't work for what you believe, but the whole way you're phrasing this, I think, is an issue. It's interesting, at that point, the time came to an end, and then he got talking to some other people. There was a guy, though, during the whole time that was talking in his ear. Whenever he got confused, this guy would help him out. And that guy came right up to me afterwards and started talking, and it turned out he was a Lutheran by background, the guy that was talking his ear, and he knew exactly what I was bringing up. I think there is more of a capacity, I think we have to have a sense of humility about what we can know, and there's more ambiguity, and especially on some of these tough issues. Now, having said that, I also saw rhetoric on the other side, and I witnessed this, for example, at our Synod Assembly, where there were people comparing Lon Maben to Adolf Hitler. You know, that now it was one person, I'm not saying the whole assembly was doing this, but I'm going, Lon Maben and Adolf Hitler, I mean, we're not talking, this is not the same league that we're talking about here. Lon Maven's the guy down the street, and he really believed this stuff, and he was just trying to do what he thought was right. He wasn't smart enough to be, you know, operate on Adolf Hitler. It's just not, you know, and Lon Maven was driving an old beater car, you know, and you know, he really was the neighbor down the street. So my caution there is, whenever we get this kind of, there's a certain kind of rhetoric almost that accompanies a certain way of thinking ethically, and I have seen it both on the so-called right or conservative extreme, I've seen it on the left, and it's very easy for all of us to slip into at various times in various situations when the pressure's on us, and we have this, again, this desire to justify our actions or our thinking. Another example of this that I was very concerned about, some of the rhetoric when you talk about, and here I'm aware of where I'm at. When I'm in the parish, the political spectrum can be broader. Now, we have it somewhat here, but I have a sense that it's not as broad here at times. But the whole axis of evil kind of talk, I found that, again, President Bush, given who he is and what he believes, has every right to lift up concerns he has about any nation where he's really concerned about it. But when you use that rhetoric of axis of evil, it ups the ante in a way that I think is unhelpful. And again, we really have to look at the language we use and how we talk about various ethical issues also. Now let me move on then to maybe some of you along the way had the opportunity to take a moral philosophy class. And the one thing I remember about my moral philosophy class was that we did a different ism every week, and you'd find the fundamental moral principle for each ism, you know, whether it was utilitarianism or emotivism or variations on that. And again, that whole effort to identify one fundamental moral principle that's somehow going to then, you just use that, apply that moral principle, and then things will fall out as either right or wrong, good or evil, and so on. Karl Barth once said that the typical ethical approach, and he's talking about this kind of single principle or fundamental moral principle type thinking, he said it's sin. And again, he is getting at this point because you're trying to, in a sense, in our uncertainty and our anxiety that we get into, we like to pick out one principle that will make things easier for us to figure out these tough issues. And he says that's sin. That's an unwillingness to accept who we are in relationship to God, accept our limitations, and go through the struggles that reason they're hard is because they're hard, and that's part of who we are as human beings, is to wrestle with some of these more difficult issues. And again, Karl Barth's not making an argument there that you can throw out the Ten Commandments or anything like that. Karl Barth would say we need to teach all of those basic things and teach them well to people. So that's, but on the toughest issues in particular, we've got to be very careful that we don't try to come up with a shortcut to deal with these kinds of things. Three basic approaches to ethics. I just want to lift them up. There may be others, but these three I think will be helpful. One is called a teleological approach, and this is where you look at the goal or the end. You know, what is our end? What are we trying to achieve here? And so we look at the ends, the consequences, and our goal is then to come up with the act in such a way that we'll have the best set of outcomes or consequences that we possibly can.
Is that on a macro or a micro basis?
What's that?
A macro or a micro basis?
Well, it could be.
Because there's a lot of ends that you can do on a micro basis,
yeah,
that may be justified by a macro consideration.
I would say yes. I mean, in a sense, that you could do this kind of thinking in both ways, depending on the. But the point is you're looking more at consequences and outcomes and not worrying so much then about motives and so on. You're just looking what's going to happen, whether your motives are good or bad. You want to know what are going to be the consequences. The big word here, deontological approach, this is where you look at what's the law or the first law of my life. Ethics that focus on obedience or doing one's duty or these kinds of ethics. You're going to do the right thing no matter what the consequences. Now, examples of kind of extremes examples of this, the German soldiers in Nazi Germany, one of their justifications for why they did what they did is that we were doing our duty. You know, we wouldn't have done this if it was up to us, but we were doing our duty, and that was the highest thing to do, to be obedient to our superiors. Immanuel Kant once said that you should tell the truth no matter what. And there's this amazing example where he says, even if somebody comes to your door and they're looking to kill your best friend and your best friend is in the back room and they say, is your best friend here? You tell them the truth. Say, yes, he's in the back room. And you go, no, you wouldn't do that. You'd lie and say he's not here, right? Isn't that what we argued? But he'd say, no, the minute you start compromising that principle, telling the truth, you're going, then that principle will no longer be something that we can count on. And so he was really strong on upholding the principle of telling the truth. That is a classic kind of thinking where you're not worrying about the consequences, you're just focusing on doing the right thing. Yes?
Well, I thought the Jesuit answer to that was, he's not, but if he were, I wouldn't tell you anyway.
Well, now that's a Jesuit. That's an example of what they call casuistry. And that's classic Jesuit thinking. That you look, no, because they're not just going to make the decision on one principle like that when you find another way to approach it. The Jesuits are masters of that kind of thinking.
The emperor has no clothes.
Yeah. Now the third way I'm lifting up is what I might call responsibility approach. And a couple of key points here. We critique any kind of what might be called a partial response approach, where you focus simply on consequences or you focus on motives or on any one ethical factor. This is going to challenge that kind of one principle thinking. The idea is to act in response to all actions upon us. Now, this is a challenge, obviously, but we take into account everything that's going on in our lives with a sense that God is somehow working in all of this, and so we're trying to, what we try to do then is to say, well, what is God calling me to do in response to what's going on in my life, and take in a whole variety of factors and actions into account. And you, let me lift up some various factors. There's consequences, motives, values, principles, facts, purposes. All of these can be part of figuring out what we're going to do. And I would lift up, probably each one of us could think of some example where we've really struggled to make a decision or come to some kind of conclusion on an ethical issue. And my guess is if you've really struggled with it, you have ended up taking into account many of these factors. I don't think I'm lifting up something that's brand new to people. I think on the toughest issues, people that are really seriously trying to resolve it, are not taking shortcuts, will end up taking many of these factors into account. Let me then briefly lift up, I'm going to call it seven characteristics of a Christian ethics of responsibility for you, and then we'll have time for more discussion. First characteristic is that it's a theological approach, and as a Christian, I take into account the Trinity, so it's Trinitarian, and the key question from this approach, theological question, is what is the will of God? So we're trying to discern the will of God. And, you know, often we see through a glass darkly or dimly, as Paul talks about. What I'm getting at here from Romans 12, 1 and 2, it talks about, well, just be transformed by the renewal of your mind so that you may discern what is good and right and true. So that's what I'm getting at, is that whole process of discerning the will of God. The question then is, we're not worried about how I can be a good person. That's just not the issue. We're not even so much worried about how I can do good works. And that's not the issue. It's what's God calling me to do, and trying to discern that and doing that to the best of our ability, both as individuals and as a community. Second is, I call it, you can call it gospel point of departure. Evangelical Lutheran Church, we added evangelical to the name when we had the merger. Evangelical simply refers to evangel or gospel. So this is a gospel based, and it means that we focus on Jesus Christ and his life, death, and resurrection, and that becomes front and center for us. It, in a sense, we can say the reality of God and Jesus Christ reveals the will of God to us, but obviously it doesn't give us simple answers because we're dealing with things that Jesus wasn't dealing with in his time and place. So as we take Jesus into account, there's still work to be done. Because we then, as part of the body of Christ, need to be about the business of discerning what God is calling us to do in this time and place. But certainly we want to keep, call it ethics with our eyes on Jesus. We don't want to, we do keep our eyes on Jesus, both as he's taking form individually and as he takes form corporately for us in our given time and place. A third characteristic is, use the word concrete. This morning, Dwayne Larson, during the Bible study, was talking about how God and the world come together. I think here Bonhoeffer is very helpful to us. He has a notion of concrete that's different than what I grew up with. For me, concrete, when I was going to school, was this, something you can touch, you can sense with the senses. Bonhoeffer says that concrete reality, the reality that comes together in Jesus Christ, combines both the reality of God and the reality of the world. And if you shortchange either part, you end up with an abstraction. So if you shortchange the reality of God, if you don't take the reality of God into account, you're going to end up with an abstract way of thinking. If you don't take the world into account, you're going to also end up with an abstract way of thinking. And so both need to be taken into account in doing our ethics, both the reality of God and the reality of the world. A fourth point, it's both personal and communal. So we want a strong emphasis on the moral identity and vocation of both the person and the community, and not give an inch on either one. So this isn't, if you emphasize the person, then you downplay the community, or no, we're going to focus on the common good and downplay the individual. No, both need to be held up, and there's some tensions when you're going to hold up both, but don't give an inch on either. That is a struggle to do at times. It's historical, and this, what I'm getting at here is that we acknowledge we have a limited point of view as human beings. There's a brief passage I want to read from Bonhoeffer's Ethics. And a little wordy here, but I hope you'll get the point. It says, when we perform an action, a responsible action, it is performed wholly within what is called the domain of relativity, wholly in the twilight with which the historical situation spreads over good and evil. It's performed in the midst of the innumerable perspectives in which every given phenomenon appears. It has not to decide simply between right and wrong and between good and evil, but between right and between wrong and wrong. It's precisely in this respect responsible action is a free venture. It is not justified by any law. It is performed without any claim to a valid self-justification, and therefore also without any claim to an ultimate valid knowledge of good and evil. And then he talks about a deep secret of history, he said, in which human beings act in the freedom of their own most personal responsibility. It's precisely those who see their action is finally committed to the guidance of God. And so we do what we do. You know, this is not saying, this is a bold approach, even as we're humble about what we can actually know. We need to finally step out and take action. And what he's suggesting, when we take those actions, then we need to finally trust ourselves to God. And I've said, if you're going to take this kind of approach to ethics, you want to have a strong doctrine of the grace of God. Because finally, Martin Luther talked about sinning boldly. I actually think this is what he was getting at. Finally, there's situations in which we need to act where we don't know exactly what's right and wrong, or what's sinful or not sinful in this, and yet we act, and we dare to even do the wrong thing at times, but we believe in a God who finally loves us and accepts us even when we make mistakes, and the confidence is that somehow God then will carry forward that which needs to be carried forward and leave behind that which needs to be left behind. Another way of saying this, finally we do our actions and we let God be the ultimate judge of those actions. Even though we all work together in discerning what we're being called to do, finally God's the only one that can make the final judgment on that. It's social, it's concerned, that's the sixth characteristic. It's concerned with our roles and responsibility in life as social beings. So we all have various roles. Some people have the responsibility of family. And even if you don't have children, if you come from a family, you have extended family. So in some way or another, you end up getting connected up with family, and there's those kinds of responsibilities. There are work responsibilities. There is being a citizen, being a part of the church. These are all various roles and responsibilities we play. I'm going to be talking more about vocation later in the week. And there are also what I call not only the responsibilities that seem like duties or things we need to fulfill, obligations we have, but there are also abilities to respond. someone who's an artist has an ability to respond, and what they do ends up contributing to the life of a community. So I think a growing edge for me has been to be opening up to the various ways that people are actively involved in roles they play that help build up a particular community. And I think it's important that we're aware of the variety of roles and the variety of ways people can build up the community. The final characteristic, it's relational. And when we do our ethics, we need to take into account relationships between God, human beings, and all God's creatures. And certainly, Bonhoeffer and others focused on the relationship between with God and with other human beings. I think in our day and age, and certainly Holden's been, I would almost say, in the forefront of some of this, is waking us up to the whole creation context that we're a part of. And I don't see how we can do ethics in our day without being very aware of our interconnectedness with the whole. It goes with the turf. Now we can't get around that. Well, I'm going to stop there. I've got some other stuff that I'm going to work in on Wednesday as an introduction to doing a case study. And we'll have a case study I've developed that I want to use there, and I'll talk about the problem of Christian ethics then and as an introduction to that. But I want to stop here and open it up for any comments, questions, issues that you want to raise. And you know, by the way we're situated, things tend to go through me, but I'm very happy to have things go like this too. And so I'll just be recognizing people. And if you want to respond to what somebody has said, just recognize, and I'll recognize you and just have you respond directly to that. All right? Go ahead.
Yeah, in the reading you did, you talked about we wanted to be like God, knowing good and evil. And so if Adam and Eve took that fruit and it gave us the knowledge of good and evil, I don't understand why it is human nature. I don't know. Maybe somebody can speak to this. Why the little boy didn't, instead of stealing, why didn't he do the good thing, which would have been maybe to go ask somebody, tell them the situation, to let somebody else be of service, which would be more healing and better for the community as a whole.
Because he was seven.
But because he's seven, but that's what I'm saying. But when you're young, why is it you know how to do evil, but you don't know how to do good as well?
Well, that may not be the case. There are probably other studies. I mean, you could argue the case that another boy could have known his sister was hungry and asked for help and received it. Mm-hmm. So there's the same side of that it's there. It does happen, but you do know it. But how it evolves into being the good and evil choices that we make, that we perceive them to be.
I want to just lift up the limited point of view, and again, that can vary from person to person depending on, because you finally can only make your decision from where you are, and you can do your homework. So I would lift up that we do, when we face tough issues, it's very important we do our homework as best we can, but even figuring out when's the time to make the decision is part of the process. So there's no magic point that says now's the time to make a decision, because you may wait too long. We have this, when we talk about Bonhoeffer, I mean, one of the things he acknowledged is that we may have waited too long to take the action we did. He was willing to accept that as a critique of himself and the conspirators, that the timing was off on that.
It can go deeper as a teacher. It has to do also with your own self-pride and your shame. Because many times we see children that, and parents, but to offer help, you know, they won't accept it because, you know, they're ashamed and they have too much pride to admit
with their situations.
They have their situation. So it really goes deeper than just, you know, stealing and, oh, they're bad because they're stealing.
Yeah, yeah. So somebody else, here we go.
Yeah. This is going to be somewhat rambling, so I'll ask you to bear with me. We were talking about the seven-year-old boy who steals food for his three-year-old sister. I sense he comes from an environment that wasn't very good, therefore. And so he does, we speak of ethics, and sometimes, and I try not to be a fatalist. I'm so lucky to have had the mother that I did, because not that I'm not sinful. I mean, some days I'm really sinful more than others. But, you know, there was a right and wrong. There was some ethics, I think, taught there. My father died when I was very young, so she was the single parent that I had. But I do tend to worry that maybe I'm just getting older. Some of the older people and the younger people, do they even think in terms of ethics? Do they even think, do they have that tool to say, no, this would be wrong and this would be right? Or are they even conscious? I guess that's what I'm, you know, did you realize that what you were doing was wrong? Well, everybody else is doing it. And more so than I think when I was a kid, although I'm sure it existed then too. But I get concerned that do they know that that's not what it's supposed to be about? We can sit here and say, well, the boy could have begged. Did he understand he had that option?
Well, as a first grade teacher in a low income area, I have this. Okay. And I don't think that a lot of the parents of those kids had, you know, and it's not a one generation thing. It's a two and a three generation thing. And I've had parents who said to me, I say, you know, you really need to sit down and talk with your child about how you need to behave around other people that, you know, you don't hit or you don't steal or whatever it is. And they say, that's your job. You're supposed to teach them that. And I said, you don't even know me. You don't know what my ethics are. You don't know what I do when I go home or how I live my life. But parents expect to lay that off on teachers. And it's not really in my job description. I mean, it is, but I have a very limited impact. So I don't think that it may be worse now than it ever was before, only because there are so many more people and the discrepancy between, you know, families that have the time to care for their children and sit down and discuss things like ethics and morals, and those that don't have time for it because they're too busy doing other things.
You're lifting up here. This is why I mentioned the notion, concern for roles and responsibilities. I mean, because when you start analyzing a situation like this, and if you're going to look at the whole picture and then try to discern how to respond to it, we have to take into account, well, where is the responsibility here? I would think, you know, even as part of society, we'd have to ask, why is it that we have children in this situation? You know, so why are in a country where we do have the means for everybody to have enough food? Now, I'm not naive, because there's a lot of factors that can lead to why this isn't happening, and we're not going to get the perfect ideal situation. But again, there's a confessional moment, and I would think as people of faith that one of the things we can do is encourage each other and then do it ourselves, is to look at not only who did the wrong thing, but what was my role in this, or what was our role in this? What can we do to respond to a given situation, and not just kind of give into it? I think back there and then here. Okay, you had your hand up in the back.
Yeah, I was just going to say, maybe getting off the subject of a seven-year-old, because the other thing you mentioned was somebody coming to the door and saying, "We're looking for your best friend. Where is he?" Instead of thinking about whether he should lie or not, why is it we think that way instead of thinking about how about upholding the traits of being loyal and trustworthy and doing the best thing that we can for other human beings?
And that would be,
and again,
that would be broadening the perspective. I mean, that's the critique of Kant, is that he was too zeroed in on one principle at that point, on the principle of truth. And let's look at what are other things. Being, what does it mean to be a good friend, is what you're lifting up there, loyalty and that. And so that broadens our perspective and how we would respond and look at a particular situation like that. Right here.
We must never underestimate the power of the devil. He's here, he's working all the time. And he's going to undermine whatever efforts, he's going to do his best to undermine whatever efforts we make.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you. Under pressure, don't we tend to do the expeditious thing for survival? whether it be taking something for somebody or protecting ourselves, protecting the man in the bathroom. Even the child, I think, has that need for survival. It's an instinct. Mm-hmm. Probably even animals have the same instinct for survival that comes without thinking.
Did someone else have other comments, questions, things that you heard that you want to follow up on?
Well, regarding the 7-year-old, in a different culture, he would automatically go to his next-door neighbor. Or I think, my impression is that in the American Indian culture, they would go to the next-door neighbor.
Well, it depends. A Cherokee never went to a Comanche and asked for food or he'd be dead. But my grandmother was a Comanche Indian. And the Comanche Indians did not have a sense of community unless you were Comanche.
Well,
if you were Cherokee, or you were Choctaw, or you were Apache, even though you were Redskin and they knew that you had a crossover, they did not have a community of the whole.
Mm.
They had a community of parts, which were very separate and apart.
Mm.
And they were, you know, you see it in German Texas. In German Texas, there are certain people that came in a wave of immigration. They live in one county, and then the second wave live in another county, and the two counties have, you know, families, and there will be people that will not let their children marry another German that lives in the same, that lives in the next door county, mm-hmm. because of the difference. Mm-hmm. And because of the, and a lot of it has to do with their sense of community and their sense of ethics, from the standpoint that they think they were, those other people are ethically impractical.
May I, just the notion of ethics I'm lifting up here, there are what we think of as case studies or specific issues, and we tend to think of those as ethical issues that need to be dealt with or ethical decisions. But I'm really lifting up here a pretty broad notion of ethics, because I would argue that what we're doing in terms of nurturing the faith, teaching morals, all of this falls under the area of ethics, because all that ends up shaping how we respond as people to what God has done. So if you want to really focus in, if theology is about what God is doing in the world, then ethics is about how we are responding to what's going on in the world. And so that's a pretty broad understanding of ethics. Not everybody's often comfortable with that broad a notion. But I would say that, in fact, when it comes to making decisions, everything that's, you know, our whole history, who we are, all of that ends up shaping who we are as people, how we respond, and it's certainly true of communities. And just what you described here, you know, if there's a community has a certain kind of identity, it's very much going to govern how they respond in a given circumstance. And to go against that is very difficult, too, if you've been trained a certain way to be part of a certain community. So there's been a lot of talk in recent years about help me out here, I can't believe it, my mind just went blank. It's been going on the different communities, they'll have 8 different...
Asset-based?
Yeah, asset-based, but there's another word for it. So virtue, how could I forget virtue? But there's different virtues, and so there'll be, like, community I was part of in McMinnville, Oregon, for 8 years, every month, there was the community and the schools in the community were supposed to focus in on a different virtue and what was trying to teach some of these basic things. And somebody was saying, you were commenting about where are people learning these things. Well, that was an effort to try to get the community thinking about it. And the thinking is if we nurture these kinds of virtues in people, that's going to help them prepare then when they are faced with difficult decisions and when they, in terms of how they relate to one another and the neighbor, neighbor and relate to the community and so on. So all of this again can be part of then shaping how we go about responding to what we see God doing in our world and how then we relate to other people and to the creation as a whole.
I like your story about how one tribe wouldn't go to another tribe for food or whatever. I'm a pastor of a town of not even 1,000 people in North Dakota, and we have 2 churches right kitty corner from each other. One German, not Missouri Synod, but German, and one Norwegian. So on a given Sunday morning, we can worship God, but we better not worship God together. I think Martin Luther King Jr. said,
that we as a country are the most segregated 10 o'clock on any given Sunday morning. Is it, and I'm not an expert on ethics. Is that an ethical question? Is that unethical to say we can worship God, but we better not worship God with you? That's got to come under relational ethics, does it not? Or
I would think there are going to be consequences, you know, in the community because of the way people are able to be together or not be together. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean you could have a situation where you have five different churches in town. And actually, the little town I was in Illinois, we had a pretty good working relationship between the different churches. And each church worshiped on Sunday, but we had some things we did together then. We had a common food bank and some of these basic kinds of things. And we could even work together if some issues came up in the school. You know, we could, we didn't do a lot of this. I wasn't there very long, but I could have envisioned those four churches helping the schools do it in the churches if it was an issue that was too hot a topic for the schools. We could have hosted that in the churches potentially there. And so I think, you know, what the relationship is between two communities will have direct consequences on how things function in the community.
The good news is in the last 10, 15, 20 years, it's gotten much better.
Okay.
Yeah. I was talking about 80 years ago when they decided should they build one church or two.
Yeah. You know, in our own church, we have that problem. We've got our church right now has a group that within the Lutheran, Evangelical Lutheran Church that have voted because of the concordance with the Episcopals. Mm-hmm. And that whole, that we have a group of pastors, some of which I know, who says that's not Lutheran, therefore we're not going to do it. And that presents to me a very ethical dilemma. And we're going through the political study of what is the church's position going to be on gay rights. Mm-hmm. Right now, we're having it in our church in Houston. And they're having studies, and we're going through the whole position of what position should the church take on it. Mm-hmm. And I think that becomes a very, all of those types of things become very ethically motivated from the standpoint of we're trying to do the theology, as you said.
And you're trying to discern what, you know, what are we being called to do. And it's tough because it's tough. That's part of who we are as human beings, is to accept the responsibility we have as human beings to deal with these issues. But even whether that gets voted on next year or not, I mean, it's coming to the assembly, there's no question about that, but even the decision whether to vote on it or that this is the way we want to handle that, that's all part of our response as a church, is how we deal with these kinds of issues, and there's more than one way to deal with them. And part of the problem I've seen, there's that issue, but I remember synod assemblies where somebody would bring an issue to the synod assembly, somebody would write up a resolution. We'd have about 15 or 20 minutes, maybe a half an hour of debate on it. Take a vote, it's 54-46%, and I'm going, what was this? What was the point of that? I said, why don't we just take an hour and divide into small groups and discuss it, and it would have as much impact or more in the actual life of the church. Now, I'm using an extreme example there, but that's even how we deal with issues becomes part of the work. You had it right here. You had...
When I was growing up, back in the dinosaur age, a mixed marriage was when one of the couple was a member of the LCA and the other was a member of Missouri Synod.
Are you kidding? That's still in Texas.
I sort of, back to your question of what ethics is, or coming out of the example of Adam and Eve and the apple, I'm struggling with what seems to be sort of being an inherent catch-22. Ethics, to me, by definition, seems to be an endeavor of trying to step back, get some distance, and gather information, survey, and make a decision. And you've talked quite well about when you decide when they're going to stop the information gathering and take some action. But when you were already reading the passage of Genesis 3, you mentioned that why did Adam and Eve want knowledge of good and evil, and you talked about justifying our actions. That makes sense ethically, but I don't think that's why they did it. I think they did it to get information. Most of us perceive information as a way to control our reality. And I think Adam and Eve ate the apple because they could, well, now we'll know more stuff, and then we can decide things, and we don't need God, we don't need to trust on God, we can just make this come out right, you know, because we know more information. Therefore, the 7-year-old who steals, you know, it's kind of like, what are my options? Well, I know I can get away with this at the store, I can feed, you know. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's an ethical dilemma, because what Adam and Eve were doing in the first place was trying to gather information, or give themselves the tools to gather information, which is precisely what you need to do ethics. Yeah. So were they doing an ethical thing? that seems to be part of human nature to me, is not so much trying to justify my actions. That's an afterthought. To me, my greatest personal sin is wanting to control my future or my present. And my arrogance is that I can do that through information. You know, so if I understand my wife just right, I can say the right thing and avoid an argument. You know, I keep trying, you know, but I mean, so I don't know what I'm trying to say, except that there's a clash going on within me here.
Well, there's, I like what you said, just to follow up on it. One of the dangers of the approach that I'm lifting up here, and I remember raising this when I was going through the University of Chicago, Jim Gustafson was teaching his approach to ethics, which has some similarities to this, and I just said, it almost seems like you have to be a University of Chicago PhD in order to do ethics then, because you've got to gather all the information, and then you can finally, you know, and the people that can really gather it well and think it through well can do it. So there is a tension there between, because this really encourages people to do your homework, gather information, and to do that, just in what you said there. What I see, though, there's a big difference between, again, recognizing what you're capable of doing or what you're actually doing when you do make a decision. And I think fundamentally, and this is why I'm arguing, this is a theological approach, I think we really run into trouble when people do not have a sense of humility before God. And so it's really an appeal here for ethical humility, and at the same time, encouraging people not to be afraid to take bold action, but to demand both things. And what I see often is a lack of humility. We'll do our homework, and then the humility goes out the window, and it really becomes us trying to control a situation, justify ourselves, whatever variation you want to put on that. And so this can work. I think this is the approach in the context of a very clear relationship to God. And you take that away, lose that sense of humility, and then it can become, I would almost say, dangerous. I mean, isn't that?
I mean, Hitler justified what he said he did.
Oh, yeah.
He would have had a great justification, yeah. Be it economic or be it political, it was still a justification.
Oh, it's deceptive stuff. Nazis talked about community all the time. All the time. Gemeinschaft. They talked about it again and again and again. And I finally figured out why you don't find the word Gemeinschaft as much in Bonhoeffer's ethics as you do in some of his earlier writing. It's because I think he was very concerned about how that word had been co-opted. Now, I've tried to recover some of that in some of my work, but even something that seemed like community, what a good concept, right? But Hitler talked about community all the time.
So do gangs.
Gangs, yeah. I saw one more hand and then we're going to be done here.
I was just going to comment that some of the things that you were talking about and certainly that you addressed as well seemed to me to hit on this notion of hubris as distinct from arrogance. Sometimes I think we use them synonymously and they're not quite the same. Yeah. Arrogance is kind of a personal trait. But hubris, as I interpret it at least, seems to be this notion of believing that you can have absolute certainty, that you can possess knowledge that sort of eliminates ambiguity from whatever question, and then operating under that assumption. That's to me what seems to be kind of, at least as I read the Adam and Eve story, kind of at the root there, because I think you're right. We are always trying to gather information precisely for the purpose of reducing our uncertainty. But sort of there's that point where you lapse into hubris is when you believe that you collated, you've got the information, and so now you can know with certainty, and then you proceed as if you know the truth.
Does someone just say
the last word here?
Oh, I'm sorry. I agree completely. I'm thinking of a politician who not so long ago said, I did it because I knew I could. That's hubris.
That's my friend.
That's beyond even arrogance.
And I voted for the guy twice, so I thought in ways he was good. Sorry to get political. But that's hubris. I think when we forget humility, we get in some sort of trouble.
Well, thank you.
Thanks. And we'll...